Welcome to the Italian Renaissance Podcast, where we discuss the culture and art of 15th and 16th century Italy. I'm your host, Lawrence Ginangeli. Andiamo avanti. Renaissance people, here we go again, back with our next foray into the history of Renaissance Venice. I feel like we've come quite a long way from the early innovations of Jacopo Bellini in the mid-Quattrocento all the way to the end of the Cinquecento with Titian. I want to tilt the scales back in time a little bit as I delicately aim to not cause too much of a disruption in our working timeline. With that, we're going to dial the clocks back several decades, back into the 1490s, to a very precise moment in the timeline of Renaissance history, one that has often been overlooked and brushed aside as simply uneventful. I am talking about the very first visit that a young Michelangelo Buonarroti made to Venice. While I try to take it easy on how much you need to listen to before each episode, I do recommend making sure that you've at least listened to my analysis of Michelangelo's Bacchus, all the way back to episode 13, as well as my more recent release on the Lombardo Workshop in Venice, episode 27. I want to be clear about a couple of things. The historical record on this voyage is scant at best. I'm not presenting to you a cut-and-dry account of what happened in Venice, but a mixture of what the sources tell us and what Michelangelo's art tells us. That said, while I will include some primary documentation, I'm going to focus on scholarship around this event, including my own research on sculpture and classical source materials as it relates to Michelangelo and Tullio Lombardo. And all of this started with a personal encounter that I had in the Metropolitan Museum in New York City last year. So follow me on this journey, walking through the crowded, winding corridors of the Met, wading through countless medieval objects, and at last arriving in their Renaissance collection. It was my first time there. I wasn't entirely sure what was in their collection to begin with. In a small offshoot of the main corridor, I stumbled into a small room of sculpture. I was alone in there, and that was my first time being by myself on my visit in the Met. People just seemed to pass by what had to be among the most impressive pieces in the collection. I read the sign telling me that I was looking at Venetian Renaissance sculpture, something that at that point I had never actually studied before. And before me was a work that obviously stood out from the rest, a work we have actually discussed briefly. It was Tullio Lombardo's Adam. My immediate reaction to it, and guys, I mean right off the bat, I was thinking, wow, there is no doubt in my mind that this artist, whoever he is, was somehow inspired by Michelangelo. It was a life-sized marble, perfectly classicized, all'antica, as we may call it. He was in perfect contrapposto, an arm raised, lips parted, absolutely refined detail. Not only was I certain that this sculpture had to be referencing Michelangelo, but I was also especially convinced that it was referencing his Bacchus. So I inched closer, sort of desperate to read the label, and to my extreme surprise, it was dated to the first half of the 1490s. I noted off the top of my head that Bacchus is from the second half, dated precisely through his correspondences from 1496 to 97. And that means that Tullio's Adam predates Bacchus, so my certain assumption was incorrect, right? My absolute certainty on the matter only showed that I am cursed with Michelangelo-tinted glasses, like so many of us are. Indeed, Adam holds the special designation of the first life-sized all'antica marble nude of the Renaissance, and it was made in Venice, not Florence. Let me repeat that. Tullio Lombardo's Adam is likely the first life-sized freestanding marble nude of the Renaissance. And let's not confuse that with Donatello's David, who holds the same earlier designation, but in bronze, right? Donatello's David is the first freestanding bronze nude, classical bronze nude of the Renaissance. So my next line of thought was that, okay, if Tullio isn't referencing Michelangelo, then Michelangelo had to have seen this marvelous work while he was in Venice. And if this is the case, then the Renaissance in Venice had a much larger impact on the history of sculpture than we realize. Indeed, it decentralizes Florence, only slightly though. A caveat to this is that Michelangelo was only in Venice for a small, undetermined amount of time in the year of 1494. The Met and other scholarship places Adam as being from 1490 to 95. That creates a version of this timeline where Adam was conceived the following year, meaning that Michelangelo could not have seen it. To me, in my view, and in the view of a great deal of scholarship that places Adam in the year 1493, there is no doubt a relationship between Adam and Bacchus. I want us to move forward with the notion that much of what I will say going forward operates under the near consensus that Adam was completed when Michelangelo was in Venice. I'll also demonstrate that by taking a closer look at the source materials and the sculptures themselves. The details of Michelangelo's time in Venice are scant, as I've said, murky, subject to speculation. We know he was about 19 years old. Lorenzo the Magnificent had recently died in the year 1492. His son, Piero, was quick to yield to the threat of French invasion. So in brief, Piero de' Medici's inaction caused the expulsion of the Medici family from Florence. In this pivotal time, Michelangelo certainly had a predilection for sculpture rather than painting or architecture, having left the workshop of Domenico Ghirlandaio. Let's not forget that it was Lorenzo de' Medici who transitioned Michelangelo to his sculpture garden near the convent of San Marco. So, with his primary patron dead, Lorenzo the Magnificent, and the family under Piero exiled, Michelangelo left Florence for Venice. The most quoted primary source biographers are Giorgio Vasari, who we talk about a lot, and Ascanio Condivi. And they do not agree on the details of his departure from Venice, why he left. I want us to be aware that Vasari's Life of Michelangelo was written during Michelangelo's lifetime, and Michelangelo was not happy with it. This is a long history that I will tell briefly. It prompted Michelangelo to hire his own biographer, that would be Ascanio Condivi, so that he could craft a version of his own history, really try to present his divine status through his own perspective. And I want to be clear that much of what we think we know about Michelangelo is a carefully constructed lie designed to make us think he was divine. Indeed, many of his fabrications carry over into how the layman thinks sculptures are made. So strong has his influence infiltrated even contemporary society. I'm here to tell you that both Vasari and Condivi do embellish stories, but we should also consider Condivi as even less objective, as the goal of his work is to transcend Michelangelo into a myth rather than a flesh and blood artist. Still, it maintains being a valuable source of information as long as we are cautious in how we value and appraise that information. It can even directly help us figure out what not to believe, because some of these are so over the top, you have to understand that it's like, okay, this is a fabrication. So let's look at these two accounts, and they do not say much at all. So Vasari states in his Lives of the Artists that Michelangelo left for the Serenissima via Bologna, but, quote, non avendo avuto in Venezia trattenimento, se ne tornò a Bologna. So not having found any work in Venice, he went back to Bologna. That's it. That's all Vasari says. The implication of the word trattenimento does imply this lack of work, and therefore a lack of money. So he had to leave. But Condivi's not going to tell that. He's not going to say, oh, the great Michelangelo couldn't find work. And in his typical fashion, he obscures those details and will not imply that the divine Michelangelo could not find employment, but rather that he generously spent all of his money on his companions and had to leave the city only after a few days. That's it. right? No more, no less. So to these contemporary writers, each with specific agendas and biases, Michelangelo found nothing in Venice. His time there only presented as a means for him to return to Bologna, where he was received with great honor. So neither Vasari nor Condivi mentioned the Lombardo workshop or the sculptural revolution happening in Venice under Tullio Lombardo. The likely truth is that Michelangelo simply was not able to find employment, and he quickly left. Somewhere around a couple of weeks, maybe, not days. Since we understand him as already having developed a taste for classically inspired art, and also conceptualizing that Adam would have been an absolutely revolutionary piece of sculpture, even as just one work to decorate the Vendramin tomb that it was designed for, a couple of weeks scouring the sculpture scene in Venice is more than enough opportunity for Michelangelo to have seen the sculpture, but more so to have actually heard about it and sought it out, looked for it, gone to see it intentionally. Scholarship tends to agree that it is highly likely that Michelangelo saw Tullio's work on the tomb of Andrea Vendramin and the figure of Adam while he was in Venice. Further, there seems to be a consensus that Michelangelo would take inspiration from it. So this isn't just a one-off shot sort of interpretation that I'm running with. It is consistently written about by experts in the field. The long and short of it is that most scholars who take on this subject link Adam to Bacchus, though some suggest that the link is actually to Michelangelo's colossal David, where he inserts inspiration from his Venetian journey. However, comparing Adam to David ignores that Michelangelo actually sculpted the Bacchus several years before he began to work on David, Bacchus being Michelangelo's first major triumph in larger-than-life, all'antica-style marble sculpture that closer engages the composition and expressive essence of Adam, but additionally, it's closer in time. Why would that influence and skip Bacchus when it looks so similar and then be projected onto David? It doesn't make sense to me. So let's look at these works and try to sort out why scholarship is convinced that there is a relationship between them. Traditionally, sculpture is a medium that was used to express stability, endurance, solidity. All of this changes with Adam. Tullio would not merely sculpt a monumental marble nude. He would defy the boundaries of marble itself, the purpose of marble, a preoccupation that is seen in Bacchus as well. In his essay titled Tullio Lombardo, Antonio Rizzo, and Sculptural Audacity, scholar Lorenzo Bonanno, the most recent scholar to actually write on Tullio, explains that, and I'm going to quote here, when it debuted in the last decade of the 15th century, Tullio's Adam boasted one of the most audaciously unsupported limbs yet to appear on a life-sized marble sculpture in Venice, perhaps even in all of Italy. Adam's apple-bearing arm not only projects forward towards the viewer, but it is also fully, dangerously released from his torso. End quote. Tullio pushed the established expectations of marble, rendering the composition of Adam as one that had never been seen before in Venice. It defied the tradition of sculpture as a medium of stability, projecting the arm, filling the form with a daring amount of negative space.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Renaissance people, if you are enjoying the Italian Renaissance podcast, I have good news. We're now active on Patreon. You can show your love for the show by becoming a patron and get access to additional resources, information, and artworks. Better yet, those who join the Renaissance Master or Renaissance Patron tier will get access to at least one additional podcast episode each month. My goal is to ensure that the main podcast remains a free, accessible source for everyone. Become a patron today through the link in the show notes to support the continued production of new episodes and help build and maintain this community. The Italian Renaissance Shop is now also active on Etsy.
linked in the show notes. Sport our logo or choose from a growing selection of Italian art-inspired designs. Discounts are offered to select Patreon tiers as well. Your support has my immortal gratitude. Now, enjoy the show.
All of these novelties are reproduced in Bacchus. The cantilevering of the arm, it's called, right? The classical pose and nudity, the instability, the eyes, the facial structure, the parted lips, and the contemplation of the figure, be it focused, like Adam, or trying to focus, like the drunk Bacchus is. Once sculpture defies expectation in its instability, the idea of an excessively drunken Bacchus becomes easier to conceptualize in sculpture, and ultimately arrives at Michelangelo's brilliantly unbalanced figure that looks as if he's about to fall over. Should we consider Condivi's account of Michelangelo's life again, commissioned by Michelangelo and designed to invent a mythology around himself, there is little doubt that Michelangelo would intentionally omit that he took inspiration from another sculptor. Indeed, he would never say it or admit it at face value. Indeed, in his telling of Bacchus, Condivi is very specific about where Michelangelo got the idea from. When discussing Michelangelo's inspiration for Bacchus, Condivi introduces it as a work, and I'm quoting here, whose form and appearance correspond in every particular to the intentions of the writers of antiquity. End quote. Writers, not sculptors. What this misleadingly suggests is that Michelangelo's ancient source for Bacchus is a simple matter of what is called ekphrastic writing, meaning written works about visual arts, rather than an actual visual reference. So Condivi is denying that Michelangelo looked at anything to conceive Bacchus, he simply read. Yet, this discounts Michelangelo's experience in Venice and his keen interest in sculptures of antiquity. Condivi is referring to the works of Pliny and his explanation of Praxiteles' sculpture called Bacchus and a Satyr, an interpretation of Bacchus that persists today with good reason. People believe that this is still how Michelangelo conceived Bacchus. So we're trying to balance new interpretations with older interpretations, and it's probably both, right? So this leads us to the next critical question in this analysis, and certainly the most elusive in any study of Renaissance art, and that is visual source material. What sculptures from antiquity were these sculptors looking at? However tricky it is to determine, some convincing claims can be made, some absolute certainties can be presented too, and one that positions Adam and Bacchus as actually being from the same or similar antique source materials. We likewise have to understand that these references are being reinvented in their new Renaissance forms, obscuring an absolute and direct link to any specific work. What I mean is, if Tullio is looking at a Dionysus, you're not going to see an exact replica of what he's looking at, but he's going to use it for form. So you're really trying to read in between the lines of a visual piece, which is very difficult to do. But it's not enough to completely throw us off track. You can sort of see and make educated guesses, not even more than guesses, about what they're referencing. But not only is limiting Michelangelo's inspiration for Bacchus simply to Pliny short-sighted, but it also upholds the unrealistic mythic status of Michelangelo as divinely inspired, rather than having concrete, identifiable sources for his works. Indeed, his ability to obscure his visual references in favor of a recognizable but unique form further aligns him with Tullio's aesthetic achievements with Adam and his classical sources. Should we reconsider Tullio's access to the Praxiteles Apollo Lykaios, if you know Greek, send me a message correcting that. It is arguable that Michelangelo's interest in Praxiteles was both textual, as Condivi says, through Pliny, and visual, through Tullio's reference
to Praxiteles Apollo in Adam. Also, Dionysus leaning on a satyr is a sculpture from the Grimani collection that was probably known to the Lombardo workshop. And it also demonstrates both compositional elements and subject matter that reappear in Bacchus, right? We've talked about how Dionysus is and isn't Bacchus. It's a reflection of Dionysus. Bacchus is a Roman god derived from Dionysus, but they have some differences. But Dionysus leaning on a satyr would be a Greek sculpture, right? That was probably being looked at when the Lombardo workshop were doing these sculptures in Venice. It is possible, and bear with me here, that visual references are passed on or inherited. And I know this is a bit of a stretch. So either they were looking at the same or similar works, copies are everywhere, or by taking inspiration from Adam, Bacchus projects some of the aesthetic and expressive content of the classical sculptures used to help create him. Does that make sense? Tullio looks at Dionysus to help create that impressive form in Adam, and rather than looking at the same Dionysus, Michelangelo sees or perceives that similar aesthetic in Adam, and it reappears in his Bacchus. So really, he's not actually looking at the Dionysus, even though he might have been. He could have gotten it from Adam instead. Does that make sense? I know that's really kind of all over the place. Anyway, a final and essential antique reference in this case. There's Apollo, there's Dionysus and a satyr, but this is going to be Antinous, who is absolutely a point of visual inspiration for both Adam and Bacchus. This one's a little more on the nose, I suppose. So Valeria Caffa, who's an assistant curator at the Museo Correr in Venice, writes a lot about this relationship, and she's produced a complete study of Tullio's sources for Adam, detailing the threads that link Bacchus, Dionysus, Apollo, and Antinous. When considering the hair and facial features, she concludes that, quote, scholars unanimously agree that Adam's head is modeled on that of Antinous, the handsome, much-depicted favorite of the Roman Emperor Hadrian from 117 to 138 AD, end quote. She's explaining that Antinous was, quote, well-known in the circles frequented by the Lombardo family, end quote. And that's including a bust of the Bithynian boy that belonged to Pietro Bembo, which eventually was attached to a torso to become what is a famous sculpture called the Farnese Antinous. The implication of Caffa's analysis that the Lombardo family knew about Antinous, including his history, suggests that they were familiar with his history as an emblem of perfect male beauty, also as Hadrian's lover, deified upon his tragic death in the Nile. And there are all these interesting connections between Antinous and Dionysus. So would Michelangelo have recognized reference to Antinous in Venice? That's still hard to say. Would he have seen Antinous in Adam, like we can today? Would he have had that visual vocabulary? I don't know. Still, it's worth noting that Antinous was likely known by his image in the period. So, possibly, right? And he might have been known as by his homosexual relationship with Emperor Hadrian, and his constant association with Bacchus and Dionysus, who was also known in the time as a bisexual figure, pursuing both male and female romantic and sexual partners. Is that crazy or what? How do we reconcile that with Michelangelo's known homosexuality? Remember, I get into this in greater detail in the episode that treats the history of the Bacchus statue more directly. Given the proliferation of antique artworks, it is not entirely out of the question that the undeniable similarities between Adam and Bacchus are a matter of simple coincidence. That the artist drew on similar sources, unrelated to each other, and thus created similar visual experiences in their works. That's possible. It is. Yet, the historical record, the sequence of events, the visual parallels, the mapping of classical sources, it really suggests a more active role by Michelangelo in elaborating upon Tullio's novel sculptural innovation. In the very least, Michelangelo witnessed in Venice the expressive potential of marble sculpture that would influence his future success. That is my view. It is impossible to say with any certainty to what extent Michelangelo's visit to Venice impacted his art. Art history scholarship does indeed favor this connection, consistently recalling Michelangelo as it relates to Tullio Lombardo's Adam, a work with far too many meaningful novelties to deny the visual impact that it would have had on a young upcoming sculptor visiting Venice. The classical references all align between Adam and Bacchus. What remains unclear are the circumstances in which that came to be. Tracing classical sources in Quattrocento sculpture is a daring task, made even more difficult when these artists aim to eliminate the record of their process. They don't want you to see specifically. They want to make a new composition out of classical elements. Still, the expressive impact between Tullio and Michelangelo is similarly sensualized due to these sources, Antinous and Bacchus, yet Michelangelo's artistic mode is altered by his own erotic tastes, enabling an enhanced articulation of androgynized homoeroticism in his works, particularly the Bacchus. I, like the many scholars who took up this issue before me, am ever more convinced that seeing Tullio's work was pivotal for the young Michelangelo, who was scouring the Italian landscape, fleeing Florence, looking for work, desperately sensitive to the classical form, an artist inspired by the Venetian Renaissance. I hope you all enjoyed this window into the more obscure side of art historical analysis, and that you were able to loosen yourselves up from the concrete and explore the uncertain potential of these artistic connections. As always, follow us on Instagram and Facebook for updates and images, and check out the show notes for all the ways you can support this project. I want to thank you all for tuning in, reaching out, sharing, telling your friends, keeping these wheels moving forward. Until next time, arrivederci.